Welcome to today's 6th CEU seminar entitled Teasing, Bullying, and Beyond. I'll be your presenter for today's seminar, and my name is Michelle Sparks. I'm an LPCC in Ohio and the owner and director of River of Life Professional Counseling. This CEU seminar is pre-approved by the State of Ohio Counselor, Social Worker, and Marriage and Family Therapist Board for all licensed counselors and supervising counselors, all licensed social workers and supervising social workers in the State of Ohio. Now, this is a very timely topic because we see just a lot in society regarding kids with teasing, bullying, fussing, cyber bullying, groups, exclusionary types of things, prejudice, and we'll look at how we define bullying, differentiating it from things like teasing, how kids today have gotten awfully creative about how they go about doing this kinds of stuff, and how there's still, even in the literature and in the legal realm, some real difference of opinion and argument about what really constitutes bullying and what really interferes or does not interfere with the educational or learning process. Well, we'll primarily today be looking at the qualities that the psych research literature would suggest are qualities of people in the bullying realm. As we talk about today, I'll be talking about a cast, so to speak. So if you think about who are the players in the narrative, I'm going to be going through those first early on here. But before we get started, I wanted to make sure we're all on the same wavelength about what bullying exactly means. Because you see, when I've dealt with some cases where sometimes the parents just slough off things that have been mighty hurtful to a child and say, oh, that's just how kids act, or, oh, that's kind of how they fuss and play around with each other. Or, well, all the kids are doing it, it's no big deal, that's just what happens at that age. So you hear all these excuses, then you hear other things where it's taken very literally. I've had situations I've had to assess and deal with through the years that really surprised me in terms of what was considered bullying, what was let go, what was minimized, and what was really penalized pretty severe. I remember one case where one of the star students in a particular school did excellent academically, wasn't so sports-minded, and so the kids on his sports team kind of mocked him. They were the so-called, quote-unquote, popular kids and the well-known families in that school system. His mom and this young man came to me, and the team, essentially, when adults weren't around, several of them ended up holding him on the ground, force-feeding him food, laughing at him, mocking him. And then finally one day, one of the teammates who was actually doing that behavior to him came up to him and said, oh, I bet you don't like what we do to you. I bet you want to kill us, don't you? And eventually the kid who had been force-fed, that was the star student, was like, you know what? Yeah, I've had enough. I just wish you guys would go away. Now, after talking with him, his self-report was he didn't have any plan of physically harming the kids back. There was no history of actually harming them. But yeah, he was quite fed up. And if someone asked him, like, yeah, you're pretty tired of us, you probably wish you could kill us, huh? Then the group of the popular kids went to the school administration, and the kid who was the one who was force-fed and ganged up against by the popular kids ended up being put on suspension. So you see how sometimes it really can get twisted around when you have different groups of people in the cast that we'll talk about today. It really, really is not just so clear cut. And we have kids out there that are hurting, and their families are hurting. Families might be part of what constitutes or weighs into some of the behaviors that contribute to the bullying or the victimization, or the different people in the cast, as we'll talk about. We talked with other people where there's just a no tolerance policy for even mocking or joking about something. I remember after one of the school shootings that was in the media a couple years ago here, a student made a comment about, oh, I would shoot a bunch of people in the school, but unfortunately this school shooter in such and such state had gotten to it first. And this kid was kind of a goofer. He would goof off. He was a clown. He was very sarcastic, but he also didn't know when to shut his mouth. And so he ended up basically getting expelled for the rest of the school year. So while he didn't directly say, you know, yes, I have a gun, I'm going to shoot the school, he made some comments that people had to take pretty seriously. Then we have the whole issue, which we'll talk about later today, of cyberbullying. Kids have gotten very creative with technology and with manipulating and messaging and things about different ways that they can destroy someone's character. So let's take a look at defining bullying in the first place. Bullying in some cases may be verbal. It might be someone's words, like name calling, attacks, something direct to the person. It might be from a bully towards a victim. But it also can be pretty indirect as well, as sometimes in the case of things that are posted on the media or someone that does property destruction or underhandedly gets other kids to kind of turn their back on one of the kids. So there's no really one set way about how people define bullying. Bullying generally is a repeated pattern of behavior. It's usually not a one-time thing. And in most cases, we're talking about a behavior where there is intent to harm someone or cause distress to them. Now, that harm could be on several levels. Sometimes it can be physical. We can be talking about physical abuse, beating someone up, jumping them, hurting them, shooting them, stabbing them. We can be talking about harming them emotionally, just really slandering their character, breaking confidences, breaking promises, posting things about them, starting gossip about them. But the idea is that there is a motive of causing distress in the victim. And one of the things we see in the literature is that there is a power differential between the bully and the victim. And this really sets up the story for the cast we're going to talk about next. So there's six different roles that we're going to talk about in terms of the cast of characters that we're going to learn about today. First of all, of course, we're going to talk about the bully. That's probably the most common character that most people are concerned about. But we also need to take a look at the victim. We'll talk today about the whole issue of, is there even a pattern of what a victim looks like? Could there possibly be some qualities that people have that make them more victim prone? Are there signals that people who are victims might give that actually makes the bully kind of egged on? Then we have a third category called the bully victim. So that's bully hyphen victim. So this is someone who may be bullied by other people, but also is victimized by people. So it's kind of a cycle where, you know, they feel hurt, whether it's at home by parents, whether it's a abusive family system, whether they're being bullied by certain kids, and then they just have had enough, and then they start to bully other people. But we have a third category of people that are both bullies and victim. The fourth category we have is the assistant. Keep in mind that the reason, or one of the reasons that the bullying works, besides the power differential, is that somebody somewhere goes along with a bully. There's someone cheering them on. If it was just them and the victim, that wouldn't necessarily be just enough to encourage the bully to keep going. Generally, there's an assistant, someone who laughs at the jokes, someone who goes along with the crime, the harm, the hurt. Then the fifth possible person that we have in the cast is the rescuer. This is a person who actually might dive in when they see an interaction where there's bullying going on. And we will talk today about some of the background of social psychology and what it says about how likely people are or are not to actually rescue or dive in when there is a potential bullying situation. And finally, the sixth person in the cast is the bystander. The person who is around, witnessing, and aware of the storyline that's going on, but chooses, for whatever reasons, not to get involved. And we will also talk about why that might be and what the literature says about that. So let's look first here, casting the victim. Are there qualities that tend to be common among people who are victimized by bullies? Well, we definitely know after someone's been victimized, even as an adult, when you think of abuse situations or hurtful, harmful situations, again, whether they're direct and indirect, whether they're verbal, physical, emotional, sexual, whatever type of harm, abuse, or bullying it is, victims generally react to situations with hyperarousal and fear. Of course, they're trying to anticipate when the next hypothetical situation might be. They feel like they have to be on guard. What next? What if? What's around the bend? Maybe they're thinking in the back of their mind, if only I said or did A, B, and C, maybe I could pacify the bully. Maybe he or she would not do or say what they've done so far. So because the bully and the people who support the bully can really sense this, there's increased vulnerability to ongoing attacks by bullies. This victim has constricted emotions and exaggerated empathy. When they have these emotions, internally, their world's being rocked upside down. They have such a high level of anxiety. They may experience depression. They may have self-loathing or self-hatred. But sometimes you see that outwardly where they just break down and cry or cover their face or whatever. Sometimes you see it in withdrawal where they won't even go to school, or they'll avoid the triggers of being around the family if the family has different bullying qualities about it. Or attending school, maybe you'll see some truancy issues. The perception of the level of threat is an issue that has really been studied in the literature. So victims, whether they're actually in the process of being victimized actively, or whether they have been a victim and it's slowed down or eliminated, there's a perception that they have that they are threatened, that the threat level is pretty high. So even in a so-called neutral situation, they're going to be hypervigilant. They're going to be worried. This was where you might even see victims of bullying having symptoms like post-traumatic stress type symptoms. There's a perception that simultaneous with the idea of an increased threat level, that they have decreased control over things, that they're helpless, that they're hopeless, that things aren't going to change. Because remember, one of the qualities we said a little bit ago about bullying is that it's generally repetitious, that it's a pattern over time. And that's where the bully's intimidation comes in. So the victim starts thinking, oh my gosh, you know, this is something that they're just doing all the time. And so it's very hard for them to imagine a world without that. They may even get into this imaginary world and wishful thinking. It's interesting because the literature calls this like rewarding the attacker with visible distress. So victims actually, whether they're intending to or not, affirm that the bully is getting a reward or something out of it. I've had situations where one of the techniques sort of that I've used with clients has been helping them to find constructive ways of de-escalating the emotions or having support systems of who they can go to and not rewarding the bully with the attitudes and responses where they're feeling like they're getting affirmed. What else are qualities? What are other qualities of the victim? Well, they tend to ruminate. They tend to have cognitions or thought patterns about, you know, what's all happened to them, what might happen in the future. So when we're talking about expectations, they have very negative global expectations, like anyone with depression or anxiety would, about the world around them. The world no longer feels like a safe place. They may have negative beliefs about other people and negative beliefs about themselves. This is also linked, as the literature would suggest, with what's called reactive aggression. So that's where you might even get that bully slash victim thing that we talked about earlier. That we just find out that they miss school, they're less liked, they're prone to anxiety and depression, as I mentioned. They're also prone to indirect physical complaints. So that's something we want to look out for, because some kids don't have the language, or maybe they feel like in life they're not given the room to say directly, whether it's to name or let people know. And bullies and abusive situations can let them know, like, you better not say anything. So they may indirectly have physical complaints. So that's something you also want to look at and work closely, say, with the primary care physician and provider of that client. These victims might even feel suicidal. They might have attempted suicide, or they might make comments that they just feel like they don't want to live. They might have a passive death wish that they say they wouldn't care if they didn't wake up. They're rated on rating scales as higher in peer problems and emotional problems. In some cases, when you see, say, a teacher self-reports behavior concerns or hyperactivity, it might be worthwhile to kind of look, is there an issue of bullying going on? Whether it's in the home, whether it's with a peer. And then also looking at what is their level of social support. Like I said earlier, we will take a look at today whether or not people intervene and what qualities the social psychology literature would say are in play when people decide whether they're going to just stand by and watch, whether they're going to excuse themselves for the situation, or whether they're going to even get involved. Now, victims can be one of a few different types. We can have a passive victim who just is so afraid of conflict that he or she is trying to avoid conflict. Avoidance is their main thing, escapism. They may even try roundabout ways to just persuade people to get off their case because they're hurt. They might be crying. They might feel rejected. So they just try to lessen the tension at any cost. You might even see someone as a passive victim, as weird as it sounds, kind of laughing and trying to use a sense of humor or distraction to try and keep from thinking about how painful some of the emotions are. And then you can have, on the other hand, an aggressive victim. who actually keeps reinforcing the bullying and is at a point where he or she counterattacks and is argumentative, disruptive, or prone to anger. It is possible, as the literature would suggest, to actually have someone escape the role of victim. So the literature calls it the escaped victim. This is someone who's much more likely to get other people involved. That's why, as you'll see today, most of the techniques that have really shown that they've been effective are ones in which the victim involves other people, or in which there's room in the school, in the family system, in the community to involve friends, family, teachers, or others. Over time, the victim who's escaped that system and that storyline learns not to take the bullies as seriously. So we're looking at the developmental path of being victimized, that it may start with a bully acting out physically against the victim, then verbally saying word attacks on them, lessening, their social support, verbally attacking them, to finally planned relational attacks, which would be things like the social media stuff we'll talk about. So there are some ways that we can help victims learn to cope. Right now I'm going to go over some generalities, but we'll talk about some specific techniques later in today's session. One of the ways we can help victims learn to adapt or cope is to help them control their feelings and reactions. They may not even have a sense that they're able to name or label what they're feeling, that they have anyone that they could go to, that they have any anonymous setting where their confidentiality is protected. Most time, there's that sense that, well, gosh, if I even went to someone, that person probably would end up talking to the bully and setting me up for more bullying. So there's a lot of fear. One of the other things we can do when we're doing therapy with someone who is a victim, whether they're a straight victim or a bully victim, is we can help them with their attention and reaction biases. Remember that people that are victimized tend to misperceive threat. Part of this makes sense because they've been threatened before. But even when things aren't threatened, they continue to perceive them as threatening. We can also help them know how to protect themselves. We can also help them have an understanding of the tactics that bullies use and how to kind of minimize things that would actually reinforce bullying. There's some coping styles that actually work according to the literature. And although some of these might sound common sense, one of these things that I explain to clients is that it takes time to develop new habits. And just because you do these things, even a few times, may not come across to the bully that you're serious. They may test and try. So one of the first coping styles that actually works for a victim is to ignore. Of course, if there's a physical risk factor there, we're not saying ignore someone while they're beating you up or your life's threatened or something like that. But when it's maybe name calling, maybe it's mocking, maybe they're just trying to act like they're having an edge on you, basically showing that, you know what, you don't have power over me. You're not so high up and I'm so low. So learning to ignore. There's a story that I use. I use a lot of games and storytelling in a clinical setting with some of the kids that I work with. And the one story is called Ralph's Purple Face. And it talks about a kid who the other children in class mock. They say, Ralph walks like he has ants in his pants. Look how weird he is. And they poke him and laugh and call him names. And they keep doing it and keep doing it until one day he has an agreement with the teacher about learning to ignore. And it takes a matter of weeks of ignoring, and the kids start wondering, like, gosh, we're not getting things reinforced, even when we say he has ants in his pants, even when we're looking at the purple face that he has and the steam and the red stuff coming out of his face and his ears. You know, we're not seeing that as much anymore. Something's different with him. You know, it takes time and repetitiveness of doing this over and over. And in the story, when I use that story, kids get to see, because their first question is, well, I've tried that. That doesn't work. They see that it might not be the first time, the second time, or a week or a month later. But eventually, the reward's not going to be there for the bully. And in that story of Ralph and his purple face, Ralph ends up learning that he is a good student, that he's excellent in certain subjects. The bullies end up coming to him, realizing that maybe he can actually help them learn better. Coping styles that work, and again, we're not saying these are effective coping styles, but sometimes verbal or physical aggression actually works. So when I have a kid who comes to me, there's a percentage of the time that someone who's victimized will tell me, you know what, I was just so tired of them going off on me that I popped them one. Or I finally called them a name. You know, they want to say I'm such and such. Well, they're such and such. And while, of course, I wouldn't affirm that, and most schools have a no-tolerance policy, there is some literature to support in some cases that it really shocks the bully, because they're like, oh my, okay, this person's not just taking this anymore. So really anything that would distract the bully, and he or she would realize that, oh, okay, the usual habitual pattern of oppression can't happen. Another one, which is funny and not natural to consider, is just acquiescing to the bully. What would it be like if, you know, someone who's victimized just say, you know what? Yeah, I guess it's pretty important to you to have your way. Seems like doing it this certain way is really important. Okay, no problem. What would it be like sometimes to actually agree with what part we could with the bully? I know that's not something you usually think of, but it really, again, catches the bully off guard. Another method that the literature suggests is helpful in terms of a coping style for victims is intentional coping. Now, with this, there's a lot of social skill development because, again, with the misperceptions and attentional biases and anxiety, other things going on, there's a lot of social skill development that usually needs to happen, both for the victim and the bully. One of the other things, another coping style that we can look at, is avoidance. So that's who the victim is. Now we're going to talk about what does the literature say the bully looks like. Now, when we're talking about bullies, we're talking about people that have a certain pattern, both in terms of their thought pattern, how they think about situations, and how they emotionally react in situations. Bullying was negatively linked with social preference, but positively linked with popularity. So a lot of times, there's a vibe that these bullies give off that, oh, other people better not challenge me. I'm really somebody. There's an egoism. There's a pride. There's a intimidation. Just like we said, the attributions of the victim tend to be off, and that's an area that we can treat in counseling. We can also treat the attributions of the bully. The bullies often have hostile interpretations of things that are innocent or neutral. I remember I had And this has happened more than once, but there's one in particular I'm thinking of, a child that I counseled who went off and started beating up another kid in his class. And I said, well, gosh, what happened? I wanted to know what the narrative was or the antecedents that were getting up to that point. And actually what the kid said, oh, this person bumped into me. They bashed into me. I was like, wow, so they just walked up to you and slammed you into something? And actually, the more we got into the story and the more I talked with bystanders and really got into it, it was something in a crowded setting in a classroom where they brushed shoulders with each other and it frustrated the person who reacted. So they shoved him. So sometimes we have to actually look at what do we really know about the situation, what are the attributions, and learning to challenge those. The other thing we know that the literature tells us about bullying is that oftentimes the bullies are pretty narcissistic. There's an ingenuine self-esteem. They may portray this aura of that they got it all together, they're in charge, they're, you know, everyone answers to them. But there's a lot of insecurity under that. We talked about bullying can be either reactive or proactive. So reactive could be a response to what they think is provocation or trouble. A lot of times bullies think they're defending or protecting themselves. They think they're sort of almost like marking their territory. And proactive is more goal-directed and deliberate. The key to keep in mind when we're treating bullies is that whether their style is reactive or proactive, both styles of bullies are coming out of a position of having social deficits, either where they're just not doing any thought stopping, problem solving, thinking through choices, or where they're just manipulative. So I wanted to compile for you a list of what the literature suggested in terms of why people bully. Basically, let's take a look at what motivates a bully. So there had been a debate over time. You know, it's interesting to read the literature if you get a chance to yourself, that some people almost look at bullies as these antisocial, rebellious kids who just don't care about anyone and don't care about societal norms and will do what they want to do no matter what. Others look at it as a power thing for trying to achieve a status. Some is just a game. Some they're just acting out what they've seen. So there's been debates about, oh, which of these explanations are right? Well, there's about 6 or 8 different explanations that the literature supports. And it may not just be one or the other. These may all be considerations. So one reason people bully is as a reaction to deviance. When I say deviance, I'm talking about sometimes if you look at who the victims are, they're just different from the bully. Maybe they're smaller. Maybe they're bigger. Maybe they look different in some way. Maybe they don't have the popular name brand clothes that the other kids do. Maybe they have a disability. Maybe their family background is different. But so when I say deviance, anything that is out of the norm of whatever the bully would say is the norm and most of the students would support might be a red flag or a warning sign as someone who might be a candidate for being a victim. Bullies also might bully because of social positioning. There's something that they feel like they get from being in control, having power, and a lot of times it's linked to elevating themselves socially. As we talk more, like I said, about the social psych part as the seminar progresses, you'll see that, interestingly enough, that when someone's being bullied, hurt, abused, or even a crime's occurring against someone, oftentimes people don't intervene. Oftentimes people think that, you know, they question what they think that they're seeing. Why bully? Another reason is that we're talking about a disturbed person. A person who has been around people with family problems, criminal problems, a person whose behaviors that were inappropriate or antisocial were reinforced. Someone with an angry or reactive personality. It could be someone with ADHD. It could be someone with a family system where there's substance use. Other people bully as a revengeful activity. They feel like they're punishing or getting back at the victim. And this is where we have quite a high percentage of those bully victims that are both victims and also reacting. Now, some bullies also see it as an amusing game. They feel like they're having fun at the expense of someone else. And that may sound very manipulative. It may sound like, gosh, how could someone enjoy doing this? But that would be the percentage of kids that we would talk about that actually move up from oppositional defiant disorder to something like conduct disorder and possibly to antisocial personality disorder as they get older. Bullies also might bully because it's a form of social communication. It's a social learning experiment to try and see what behaviors help them to be included and what makes them excluded. And finally, another reason why bullies bully, they're not thinking ahead. Sometimes they lack problem-solving steps. I've had some kids that are just so reactive that there's no thought stopping. And if they feel any level of emotional dysregulation about a task, about a stress, about something not going their way, about life being overwhelming, they don't know how to handle it. Interestingly enough, there's been studies out there that interviewed and asked children's ideas about why other children bully. Let's hear what they said. They said it could be because of how someone acts. It said it could be because of their size, who their friends are, what groups they're in, because they're the teacher's favorite, or because there's something that the victim has that they want. So it could be money, talents, could be jealousy or manipulation. It could be from the child's idea that they think that the bullies would feel better after they acted out. Or if they wanted something like new clothes or a certain type of toy or a certain thing that the victim has, they could intimidate them into doing what they want by bullying them. But what's interesting, finally, is that children actually had the perception that other kids bully because the victim looks like someone who's easy to bully. So in many cases, it's not just a random thing. Now, we talked about bully-victim dyads. There's this push and pull. Think of when, if you counsel adults or couples, you know, when we have marital counseling, the systems approach is really important because what we have going on with bullies and victims is there's a combination of the point of view of the bully and his or her desire to get social status, approval, and gains, and then the combination of the point of view of the victim who's easily hurt, wants others to listen to him or her, and feels isolated. So that's where we get these bully victims. Bully victims may end up having more externalizing problems because they just don't know how to process the emotions. They may have poor emotional regulation and lack some problem-solving capacities. There may be impulsivity, reduced empathy. Empathy is something, you know, we can't assume that people have that. We really have to teach that. Like, for me, that's one of the foundational skills I work with kids on, is how do they put in words, like the I messages, This is what I feel. This is how I see the situation. This is what I need right now. Or this is what I don't need. And then teaching kids, how do they do perspective taking? Even when someone seems different from them about how they look at things, how do they consider someone else's perspective? We talked about the role of appraisal. Again, both bullies and victims have a problem with how they look at situations. Negative appraisal is a factor in both bullies and victims. So we can look at coding, which cues from the environment they're paying attention to, their interpretations of others' events and causal attributions, what their personal goals are, and what would be healthier ways of achieving them. Helping them do the problem solving and helping them know how to implement responses. What we see in the literature is that there's biases where they see things as more hostile than they are. They don't look at the whole sense of cues and the whole context oftentimes. Often they're just looking at a few cues and saying, oh, like the example I gave earlier of this person brushed up against me. Huh, they're trying to knock me over. Instead of, wow, the classroom was crowded, there wasn't much room to walk by, they're trying to squeeze by, but they only had so much room. And so cues might also be encoded wrongly. They have hostile attributions, and this might be a person who has a hard time even generating pro-social responses. So if you look at these next few slides, these are examples of exercises I actually might do with a victim or a bully. It's kind of funny, like things like from like the highlights magazines or things where it's like what's going wrong in the picture. And they're silly and they're funny. And so using a sense of humor really can help the clients to engage with you. But the fact is, it helps them to look, what in the world's going on? What could go wrong? Well, let's look at this one at the pool. Well, first we have a girl. Instead of using suntan lotion, she's putting ketchup and mustard on her skin. What can go wrong with that? We have someone putting a submarine in a pool, and there's fish in the pool and a shark. We have someone trying to float on a stack of books. We have, what else here? We have all kind of animals that shouldn't be outside with people, like walruses and octopus and a shark. We have something that doesn't even add up. We have someone making a snowman by the pool. So as silly as this sounds, we're talking about appraisal exercises. You see, there's a few other slides I even included in here. And this is where, you know, to look, to help them learn to look at a situation and see what could go wrong. What I've even done, I've even taken pictures out of magazines or just a generic photo where I'm like, okay, let's take a look at this. Let's make up a hypothetical story. What do we see happening? What do you think the characters might be thinking? And how do we know that? How could we find out accurate information? So really slowing it down and pausing. Now, I'm going to read to you a few examples of appraisal exercises, little stories or things that you could go over with clients to help them to consider how perception weighs into their effectiveness or lack of effectiveness in dealing with stressors. So the first example here says, I was walking to turn in my paper by putting it inside the basket on the teacher's desk. On the way to the teacher's desk, I was hit on the arm. I turned around. It was Jimmy. I knew it. He's always in trouble, so I pushed him back. When the teacher talked to him, he denied anything. He said he was just waiting to turn in his paper, too. Something hit my arm. I was looking down at my paper for a second, and my arm got hurt. So we could look at that and then help our clients see the broad array of possibilities. So we have a number of kids going to turn in work. We have an area with people crowded around by it. We also have this student who's saying, I was looking down at my paper for a second. That's when I was hurt. So there might have been some reduced self-awareness even on the part of the person who ended up hurt. Now, it's interesting that he brings up, well, it's Jimmy. He's always the one in trouble. That might be true, that kid gets in trouble, but regardless, one of the things we see as a deficit in both bullies and victims is their ability to just test things out, see if it was a situation where that's the case or not. Let's look at the next example here. I've always liked Johnny. He's so cute and nice. A few days ago when I looked my best, I was walking down the hallway and he came out. Just my look. But instead of him saying hi, he giggled and acted weird. Now I know for sure he doesn't like me. See, the trick is there's ambiguous cues. And what happens often is that the person that we're dealing with in the counseling office hasn't really gotten all their information or tested things out. So this person's hyper-focusing on, oh, he giggled, he acted weird, and they're focusing on ascribing a meaning to that that may or may not apply. Does giggling mean that someone doesn't like you? In fact, there's some certain ages and certain type of people who giggle more when they do like you. Let's look at another example here. After a lot of coercion, I agreed to go to the happy hour event Friday night. I'm anxious as it is, but now I know my anxiety is based on reality. As I walked in, several people turned my way and had grins on their face. So imagine if you have someone who already has social anxiety. Maybe they already feel bad about being out in public and were kind of apprehensive about that in the first place. Now they're looking at some look on people's face and assuming it's a grin when it may or may not actually be a grin. And even if it is a grin, it may or may not even be about them. So there needs to be a way to test it out. And if it even is about them, is it possible at all that maybe it could be a grin of curiosity? It could be that they notice that you're a new person in the environment that they haven't seen at that happy hour before. Could it be that they're looking at your clothes and be like, wow, that's a cool outfit. I've never seen that. Let's look at one more example. My parents told me sometimes you just have to take matters into your own hands. So the other day I went to homecoming, and wouldn't you know, my arch rival wore the same exact dress as I do. What's her problem? After she heard me telling the other girls in the lunchroom about the dress that I got, I know she did this just to create a fight. Come on, sister. So again, a lot of assumptions. So, first of all, is it a fact that this girl actually knew what dress you'd be wearing? Now, let's look at some of the other people in the cast, because we talked about the bully, the victim. One of the things we haven't talked about are the defenders. there are people who, you know, it goes down to the question, who jumps in? And why don't so many people jump in? Those who feel like they're not going to lose their status among peers, they're pretty self-confident, they're liked enough, but they also are valued in principles, tend to be the defenders. They're well-liked, they're popular, they may discourage bullying and validate and support the victim. What about non-responders? There are several reasons people might not respond. One is what the social psychology literature calls moral disengagement. They might normalize bully behavior. Can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, oh, well, that's just how boys are, or kids that age, that's just the stuff they do, or nowadays, you know, they're going to joke like that. I've even heard situations that sounded rather violent and abusive where sometimes a teacher, a parent, or someone actually would normalize and say like, oh, well, that's just how they tease each other nowadays. Another thing is called victim dissociation. Sometimes people who see the incident believe that, well, I'm not like that person. I don't need to get involved. There's an idea of what also they call the responsibility transfer, that others can help, not me. So more than even the percentage of bullies or victims are the non-responders. If you've ever heard about the Kitty Genevieve case and some of the other social psychology cases, there were cases and examples of people who were in the middle of crimes, even in broad daylight, screaming help, being raped, being in trouble. And in spite of the signals, people were around but didn't intervene. Let's look at some examples here about bystanders. There was a situation where over 50 people watched a girl be raped after her homecoming. Another situation, a girl was raped by a college football team, and they made a video and picture circulating to over 20 people who did nothing. The classic social psychology case is Kitty Genevieve. She was raped and stabbed in New York City, and no one did anything because they just said it was, quote, probably a lover's quarrel. So what do we learn from these? When there's uncertainty about cues, people don't know whether to look at this as an actual emergency or not. They also look to see if other people are responding. And if they don't see other people responding, they think, well, then why should I respond? There's this term, diffusion of responsibility. They think that basically if there's more people that could respond that don't, then there's less individual responsibility anyone has. That's kind of sad, though, because imagine like the situation with a football team raping someone or a crime in broad daylight. If I'm thinking, oh, like Kitty Genevieve, this is in New York City, or after the football game or after a dance, a group of people are at a party and something's happening, that makes it problematic because people are thinking, well, if it really was a date rape, if it really was a crime, you know, other people would know too. I'm probably just, you know, assuming something that's not true. Interesting thing, when there was a crowd, less than 40% helped. But when they were alone, over 70% helped. They did social psychology experiments on things like whether or not people would intervene if there was smoke in a classroom and, you know, they didn't know what was happening, or if they'd ask a question. So what we need to teach people is the idea that we're all responsible. When we're not sure, we need to assess the cues. We need to get whatever information, and we should never assume other people are or are not going to get involved, or something may not be as serious as it could be. We'd want, if we were in an emergency, for someone to respond and be there. A third social psych lesson that we learn about bystanders is the characteristics of the person who's being hurt and victimized also make a difference in terms of how much someone gets involved or not, and the possibility of retaliation. Some people think, well, if I dive in, what's going to happen? Social media and the bystander effect even makes it more complicated, because now we have situations where, because of the things being more anonymous and having social media and computers to hide behind, that we don't get as involved. So the bystander effect's even worse in social media things. We're falsely assuming in many cases that people are getting what they deserve on social media. That we believe on social media, if people are posting things and others aren't getting involved, then maybe we shouldn't either. So in terms of bystanders, there's four key things that we really need to teach. And I think this needs to happen in terms of our classrooms, in terms of when we're helping young people know boundaries and self-care and just self-respect. But one is, we need to teach them that they have an array of choices. They don't just have to quickly respond. They don't have to feel trapped, but there are choices and options. The second thing we need to teach them is that it is okay to get others involved if they're unsure, so that the ambiguity can be interpreted correctly. Then if interventions need to be done, we can really look at the details and the context. Third, we need to try not to assume that someone else is helping. And we need to teach that everyone has a responsibility. So as we go through those ideas that I just shared, I want to share some examples. And I'd like you to think yourself how you would handle it, what you would do. Because again, keep in mind, what adds to the bullying and the victimization is when situations may come across as ambiguous, or when the interpretation may go a certain way. What would you do if you witness a girl yelling, "Stop, stop, you're hurting me," to a boy she's with? Again, that could mean a lot of things. It could mean that he is beating her up or abusing her. It could mean that by accident there something's happening and she's just saying, "Hey, let's cool it. I'm laughing too hard," or "I'm, you know, whatever, that I don't want to keep this up." What about the second one? You hear a mom berating her child for being too fat and not needing to eat any more sweets. Do you get involved? Do you say anything? What about you overhear a group of people talking about making sure everyone hates Bill as much as they do? Again, gossiping, telling stories, whether they're true or not. The fact is, the goal is to hurt someone, to destroy their character, to make others agree about how bad they are. What about, what would you do if you're typing a message to someone in a friend group when you come across a post that says, "Why should we even keep Mary alive?" Wow. Is that just saying that we don't need her? She's not in our cool group. Let's not bother with her. Or could that be someone really planning to harm or hurt someone. What about you hear a group of guys talking about their little black book? How they're going to see how many of them can rate and score with anyone that they can, because they know who's easy. And finally, what about you hear some people mocking a cutter, someone who's done some self-injurious behavior, telling her, like, you better do it right next time. How many times do we see people that end up being told, oh, it's just for attention? We really need to evaluate those situations. So one of the types of approaches the literature talks about is called email peer support. So this provides a safe venue for someone to send their concerns via email to someone. It's anonymous, so they can use a code number or whatever, but not, you know, have to have it come back on them. Confidentiality is protected. So if they do end up, say, sharing it with the potential bully or intervening, they can intervene while protecting other people. So the email peer support is really a program to empower bystanders and to help overcome that bystander apathy that we talked about. The schools and settings that have had this have generally guaranteed that they would respond to this email peer support system within 48 hours or less. So that in of itself can be comforting for a lot of people, that they will be heard, their concerns will be acknowledged, and that someone else is going to be checking in to the context of things. So when people have these contextual assumptions and attributions, this helps to check it out. So something like this might be run by peers, but mediated by revolving teachers. And it's run through school email accounts of students. You might have groups of four students and at least one teacher. The students would end up drafting a response to the teacher, and the teacher would make ultimate decision about what the response is. So that could be anything from how to balance out work and outside time, how to deal with peer pressure, how to cope with hurts and pains, how to react to bullying or teasing, how to develop skills like problem solving or decision making. So one of the things that also might be something to be aware of that the literature talks about is that a lot of times people who are bullies are, and there's that power differential basically between them and the victim. So there's this group hierarchy where the bullies tend to be what they call the generals. Then in the middle we have lieutenants, and at the bottom we have the victims, who are considered the least effective leaders. Bullies over time, without intervention, become better bullies, and victims become better victims. Unfortunately, a lot of times this is reinforced by teachers and systems. More than not, the system gets reinforced. So how can we break this cycle? We could equalize the social structure of the group, help enable the weak, and demand help from the strong. Now I want to introduce this concept of cyberbullying. This is a new way to hurt a victim. Remember, bullying is with intent to hurt. So when we're talking about cyberbullying, we're talking about using messaging, hacking, name-calling, gossiping, even ignoring or excluding someone from a group, copying personal conversations or forwarding them to others, making malicious websites, accounts, or profiles, sending threatening emails, humiliating someone in an open chat room. And one of the things to keep in mind is parents tend to underestimate the degree to which a cyberbullying is going on. Just because it's a different venue doesn't mean it doesn't have the same goals or similar goals to the traditional bullying that we might have grown up with. Cyberbullying also is intended to create hurt. It's perceived as hurtful by the victim. It's part of a broader negative pattern of both online and offline behavior. There's generally that power differential that we talked about and the power imbalance. It's a type of relational aggression. So even if people are removed and they're not face to face, keep in mind, again, this is a relational aggression. There's factors like manipulation, defaming someone, or gossiping. The techniques may include things like harassment, denigration, impersonating someone, tricking them, or excluding them. I'm going to just read a quote here about defining cyberbullying before we go on here. An individual or group willfully using information and communication involving electronic technologies to facilitate deliberate and repeated harassment or threat to another individual or group by sending or posting cruel texts or graphics using technological means. So why would someone do this? Are the reasons the same as bullying in general? So one is entitlement. People think they have a right to harass others because they're superior. Sometimes, like in the case of bully victims, they're both a bully and a victim. So they might be a target of harassment. So they might feel justified. They might be, in their mind, simply retaliating to being bullied by others. They might be victims of retaliators. There's also bystanders, as weird as it sounds. Even though there's things being filtered through the media, there's still, with cyberbullying, individuals who are either encouraging the bully, who are assisting the victim, or people who do nothing. Maybe they don't like the post on social media. Maybe they don't respond to it. Maybe they don't say something against it. They just scroll past it, but they saw it. And finally, we do have individuals who seek to stop the bullying. In the literature, at least 20% of kids reported being victimized online. Almost half of them witnessed online bullying towards someone, and over half of them, about 60%, felt they were negatively impacted by cyberbullying. So it's affected their lives. This isn't something we can just turn our gaze away from. Keep in mind, just about everybody these days has internet. And then with the recent stuff with coronavirus and society and kids using more technology and part at home, and I know even at a young age, like my girls having to use Chromebooks, a lot of the classes not using the traditional textbooks like when we grew up, there's a lot more online time. And kids are a lot more cunning with use of technology. They learn it at an earlier age, and it's super accessible. Parents don't have time to monitor. You know, what's interesting to me, when I do family counseling, or even if it's counseling with a young person, a lot of times when we'll look at rules and consequences, even if the parents have a rule about limiting time on the computer, there's really very little parent monitoring. The parents might still be at work when the kids get home from school. How in the world are they going to be able to monitor that time? Or if the kids are saying they're doing one thing online, how do we really know that? They could be saying they're doing homework and they're looking at whatever. But we do know that those who are involved in cyberbullying tend to have lower academic performance. They tend to have higher stress levels. There's low self-esteem. We talked about depression and anxiety earlier about victims and bullies. But it's no different with the cyberbullying. The other thing that we notice is that cyberbullying, keep in mind, isn't just about computers, but it can be what is text, or if you're texting a group, who's in the group? Who's the message sent to? Who's it not sent to? There's so many different venues out there and apps now. One of the things to keep in mind, and I would encourage you to really listen to this, because I think this is really key in terms of how you would approach cyberbullying as well as regular bullying. Those who are most at risk for bullying in real life are also those most at risk for bullying online. Cyberbullying, in fact, can be even higher than regular bullying, especially nowadays, because people can be autonomous or anonymous, that you can simply friend or defriend someone. You can post negative things or untruthful things. You can create accounts, pages, stories, lies. You can do that under someone else's name. While that would be fraudulent, people do that. People mass spread gossip quickly. If you really want to destroy someone's character, that can happen fairly quickly. I wanted to read a quote that the literature talked about. With a schoolyard bully, both the bully and the victim can read each other. Social cues like body posture, speaking volume, facial expressions, and level of engagement. Cyberbullying removes all of the social cues that are earned through face-to-face interactions, and the bully and victim are left with caustic words being exchanged without other interactions. So with cyberbullying, why would people do this? There's a sense of disinhibition. People are anonymous. Things don't really have to necessarily easily be traced. There's a transition between what we call the public self, the self face-to-face at school or in social settings, versus the private self at home, online, behind a screen, behind a cell phone. And again, there is really a lot of lack of adult interaction. There's also an issue of, do the kids have many positive social role models? Let's look at what the psychological effect or impact of cyberbullying might be. Again, we're talking about depression. We're talking about anxiety, worries. Some kids don't even want to go to school. I mean, if someone can be that creative and destroy their character outside of school, and then they have to go into school, and who knows what was already said about them. Another side effect is poor self-esteem. Diminished school attendance, ruminating and thinking. Their time's preoccupied with this. One of the things I found fascinating too is it's not just during school years, but when they've done longitudinal studies, they have found that even years later, people can be preoccupied about incidents that happen against them during their school years. Some people may even become more antisocial. In fact, one of the studies talked about as much as 60% of cyber bullies had at least one crime by adulthood. Now, like I said, looking at cues is one of the things that's very ambiguous. Let's look at some examples. I'm just going to read them to you, and I encourage you to almost like vote about if you think this is even prosecutable cyberbullying. 20 California students viewed graphic threats against another student on MySpace. Students in a Michigan high school were posted drinking alcohol and engaging in illegal activities in online journals. Teenage boys posted a video about how to make destructive devices and firearms on their web pages. A preteen sent out a threatening internet message to her classmate saying she was going to bomb the school. The University of Dayton considers checking out employees' Facebook and other profiles as part of the hiring decision. A teenager impersonated a school teacher and posted some negative things about the teacher on Facebook. So one of the things I want to say is that the literature is so ambiguous about how to deal with these things, primarily because when we're talking about school-age children, in the courts, there's a lot of debate about if these things impact the learning environment, because oftentimes the stuff that's done in terms of cyberbullying is outside the traditional classroom day. Obviously, there's specific threats, like someone bombing the school or doing something that's going to harm another person. There's some specific things there. But sometimes some of this other stuff, it's in the literature, some of the cases, they weren't even able to give a guilty verdict because they said they didn't feel like it impacted the learning process. Let's look at some other examples. What about if a teenager wants something, so he uses his uncle's credit card while the uncle's finishing dinner just to buy things online? How about if a child pretends to be an adult they know just to have access to their financial accounts, personal information, and medical records? How about a teen or a preteen pretends to be older to create an account on a site that's supposed to be for people over 18. How many times do we hear about this? What about some kids agreeing to access a fellow student's email account and profiles online to change and alter the student's information? Students using emails, IMs, chats, and postings to make sure that other students do not like a particular person. So now that is with intent of harming someone. What about when a girl breaks up with a boyfriend, she creates a web page slandering the new girl he's dating, so the whole school will hate her? Some teens think it's funny to take pictures of people in the restroom and dressing rooms, to laugh at the people's different bodies and reactions when they're surprised. What about this one? Teens eavesdrop on private conversations by installing a recording device without the consent of the person who's talking. So when we're talking about is something prosecutable cyberbullying, there's a classic case called the Tinker case in 1969. And what came out of that case was, unless the material disrupts the learning process, schools cannot restrict it. But there's been very discrepant rules in different states. So then what do we do? Some of the responses people have had is having more strict school and family policies, peer programs to help people be able to report things that are concerns, education, so that could be through the counseling office, that could be through the guidance counselors or school counselors, it could be social skills training. Another intervention some people suggest is having cyber cops or actually rewarding kids for reporting and stopping bullying. The things they suggest is teaching kids about what information they should or should not post and how that information could be misused, discussing consequences of cyberbullying, limiting the time online or why that's important, making sure kids have a productive purpose for their time online, limiting areas of inappropriate conduct, having accountability, considering the effects on your reputation before you do something, and set regular reviews about children's accounts. So part of the problem is that, like I said, parents have to work. They have things to do themselves. They may have multiple kids. They don't have the time to keep on track about all these things. They might not have the know-how even to log in or to keep tabs on some of the stuff. So some of the things that they suggest that the parents look for are things like withdrawn behavior, signs of depression. They talk about opening a door of discussion with your kids to talk about how to be kind online and how to protect themselves in terms of limiting what they're saying, personal details about themselves or about other people. They talk about having an open door between parents and school officials. Kids need to know that there's a team of people that are around and that are involved. Because when we talk about interrupting a cycle of victimizing and bullying people, one of the biggest factors is people just knowing that other people do care and are watching and will be involved. They also suggest for parents to remember that kids, one, they're impulsive. They don't think ahead. They want friends. They're quick, maybe, to make some actions, but they don't always think about the consequences of actions. And they, even more than adults, might be prone to the disinhibition because of it being online. They also talk about parents being role models about appropriate internet use so that kids see what needs to happen. Parents should set time limits on internet use. Have even a contract, which I thought was a cool idea, about what types of things are okay and not okay online. Even where and how computer time is set up could be important. It's good to place the computer in a visible place. Encourage your children to report cyberbullying. Use filtering and blocking software. And teach kids to protect themselves. So I want to review what we talked a little bit about in this first section. We talked about how there's a number of people in the cast surrounding bullying. It's not just about the bully and the victim, but a number of people have qualities of both bullies and victims. There's also people who obviously reinforce what the bully does. Otherwise, he or she wouldn't be doing this. Then there's people who potentially could intervene. And bystanders. We talked about the fact that just because someone could intervene doesn't mean that they always do. There's a number of reasons why people bully. It's not just that they're wanting to hurt someone, but it could be to keep their social position. It could be because the other person's simply different from them and they're an easy target. It could be as a game or a revengeful activity. It could be a means of communicating something, or it could be that they're simply not thinking ahead. We talked about a few beginning general ideas about dealing with bullying, and we talked about how bullies can really sort of sense triggers with the victims, and so we want to empower them. Appraisal is one of the key things that we want to work with people about. We also talked about the social psychology examples where people, even when they're in a situation witnessing what could be bullying, tend to not respond because of moral disengagement and because of thinking that other people are responding instead. This can be extremely dangerous. We talked about things like cyberbullying and why this is a concern nowadays, why people are tending to go more to this. One, there's just the increase of technology, and the sense of disinhibition is so high that there's little parent monitoring, that kids tend to be impulsive, and that there's such ambiguity in the literature about what in the world can be even prosecuted. So when we return, we're going to start looking at how do we distinguish between teasing and bullying. Like I said, we hear these comments about, oh, kids will be kids, they're going to do what they're going to do. And then sometimes you see behaviors and you're like, is that teasing or is that really bullying? So think about that, and we'll be back shortly for the second part here.